Lars. So I guess I'm here today giving the first of the Blackboard lunches associated with the program called Quantum Gravity Fundamentals from the IR to the UV. As you might expect, with a title like that, you know, the program is a broad, wide-ranging thing that addresses a wide variety of issues. You'll either be happy or sad to learn that I will say we'll address only a small subset of those today. I've decided that I should carve out a tiny niche where I can stay true to what I understand the spirit of this talk series to be, to explain to complete novices and non-experts why some of the things we're doing are interesting, and to do it in finite time. Okay? That's my goal for today. I have two messages for the experts. No matter which program you may be technically here with, if you are an expert, you will learn absolutely nothing from my talk. Yes, I'm aware that I'm glossing over certain technical details. Please let me go and eat your lunch. Unless it's truly critical that you enlighten the non-experts. All right. So the particular slice of topics that I've decided to focus on relates to something called the ADS-CFT correspondence that most people in the audience will at least have heard the name. Okay. Let me remind you, in the broadest possible brushstrokes, what it is. In 1997, Juan Malacena taught us that the consistency of the ideas known as string theory implied that string theory, with certain boundary conditions, must be equivalent to a standard quantum field theory. The string theory is some 10-dimensional theory, and the quantum field theory is a smaller number of dimensions. Now, that brief summary immediately raises several questions for the non-experts, some of which I have written on the board. What is string theory? What is ADS space? I'm not going to bother to define the other half of this. I'm just going to call it a standard quantum field theory, and most of the non-experts present will know enough about that to be fine. And perhaps most importantly, what does equivalent mean? What does it mean that these two things are the same? I've written down here a more refined version of question three, because I know people here like to ask picky questions. What is the actual dictionary that relates to them? Okay. I am not going to fully answer all of these questions here today, but I'm going to address them. As a relativist by training, and thus a geometer, this is my favorite question among this list, not the least because it is easy. Okay. These questions are some of the ones that, in honest truth, we are discussing in the program still. Let's see, 97 to 2015, what is that, 18 years later? Okay, so, you know, to get these questions right in detail is hard. And I'll tell you a little bit about where we are and some of the frontiers of research in this direction. What is string theory is a question that is also in principle hard, and I will explain bits of that. It's hard. I'll just admit that in most contexts, we don't have a full non-perturbative beginning from first principles definition of string theory, only a perturbative definition. However, to show you enough string theory for me to use in this talk is relatively easy, because I'm going to just consider things in a limit that simplifies the entire treatment. So what I plan to say about what is string theory actually fits in this space. Until much later, anyway. All right. So without further ado, let me hop in here and try to answer this question of what is string theory, or what do you need to understand about string theory to follow my talk? So as you've all heard in colloquia for the last 45 years or something, what's the right number? Anyway, at least 30 years. String theory is a theory that is much like quantum field theory in many ways, except that it replaces point particles by strings, relativistic strings. The important thing to know about a string is that it's really a rubber band, and it has a tension. Okay? And so a relativistic string is characterized by a tension, which is an energy per unit length. And if it's a relativistic string, then you tend to set C and H bar to 1, so that energy and 1 over length have the same units, and you write this as 1 over the strain length squared. So what you need to know is that in the limit, where the strain length goes to 0, that tension becomes very strong. And of course, the strings collapse back into points. You can treat it like quantum field theory for many purposes. Okay. So in fact, in most of the way I'm going to treat string theory today, I'm going to take this limit and pretend that it's a sort of standard quantum field theory, glossing over many details. One detail that I will not gloss over is that an interesting thing about string theory is, it's not just one quantum field, it's a whole collection of quantum fields. Each normal mode of oscillation of a string corresponds to a different field. And an interesting thing about the consistent string theories that all of them turn out to contain a graviton, or gravity, in this field theoretic limit. So when I say this limit gives us a normal quantum field theory, well, that's true to the extent that gravity can be treated as a normal quantum field theory. So hidden in string theory, there is a parameter that plays the role of Newton's constant for the gravitational field. It's nice to write that as another length and to talk about the Planck length, which is just a length scale built out of Newton's constant, h bar, and g, and that parameterizes the sort of strength of the gravitational interactions. So, as I mentioned, in this L string goes to 0 limit, string theory can be treated as something like a standard quantum field theory, but with gravity. As you've probably all heard, and I'm not going to belabor right now, quantum gravity is hard and has all kinds of problems we don't understand. Therefore, since I want to work in a limit where this theory is easy, I will also pretend that this Planck length is very small. That corresponds to taking Newton's constant to be very weak. And in that limit, I can treat string theory as what is effectively a theory of classical gravity, more or less general relativity, with small perturbations, small perturbative fields propagating on classical background. So for the purposes of this talk, when I say string theory, you can think about some classical theory of curved space-time with quantum fields that propagate on spectrum. Okay. Very good. No questions yet. Great. Uh-oh. I knew I shouldn't have done that. All right. Not least expert first. Yes.
It's a naive question. So
sure.
We consider string. Do you consider string has a base point?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Do you consider string has a base?
No.
But then when it collapses, where do it collapse to?
The center. Center of mass.
The center of mass.
Yeah. Eva.
Does that mean there's no firewalls?
I should have mentioned that one of the things I will say very little about in this talk today is black hole information. So let us wait and see if there are firewalls or not. Okay. All right.
Wait, just to add one.
Yeah.
LS and LP are very small. What are they small compared to?
The things you want to study. I will explain this in a moment. When I explain to you what anti-de Sitter space is, I will effectively introduce another length scale, and the answer is small compared to the scale of radius of curvature of that space and other things relevant to it. Yep, good question. Or said differently, what I really mean is something else. There's some dimensionless number that I have yet to tell you about, that we'll tell you about very shortly, that is in fact large.
Great.
Okay, so as I said, as a relativist, I'm very excited to tell you about anti-de Sitter space. Not only what it is, but why it's relevant to this problem. So in this limit that I'm discussing, string theory can be treated as basically a classical field theory of gravity interacting with other fields, plus small quantum fluctuations. And so the reason that anti-de Sitter space is relevant to this problem is it turns out that I will write it this way. Can the string theory admits a solution? A certain 10-dimensional space-time that I can write as anti-de Sitter 5 cross a 5 sphere. So 5 dimensions here, 5 there, 5 plus 5 is 10. And I'm a relativist, so this includes the time direction, which sits here in this factor. Okay. I will tell you a little about this in a moment, but I should first admit that this is supposed to describe the geometry of the space-time. And since this geometry is not flat, you might expect that there's some matter source in the problem, which is sourcing this gravitational field. And that's true. That's the rest of the solution I should mention. There is, indeed, in this problem, a field which, for non-experts, is a sort of higher-dimensional generalization of a Maxwell field. It's technically a five-form field strength, but that's not really that important. And it has a certain field configuration in this space-time that supports this geometry. In particular, I will mention that anti-de Sitter space is typically associated with negative cosmological constants. It's a property of string theory that it has no fundamental cosmological constant. It merely happens that this configuration of matter fields, if you ignore the S5, produces in the equations of motion a term which acts like an effective cosmological constant in a lower dimensional spacetime. Okay. All that's important about this field is that it defines a charge. And this is the answer to Matthew's question. It's a quantity as a five form that has a well-defined integral over this five-dimensional sphere. And this is more or less like a Gauss's law integral for a Maxwell field. So it computes some kind of charge. And just like for a Maxwell theory with a compact gauge group, the charge is quantized. And so this is to be thought of as some integer n. And it's this n which controls the strength of this field, and therefore, it turns out, controls the sizes of the S5 and the ADS5. And in particular, the answer to Matthew's question is that both of these things are characterized by a length scale, which I will call the ADS length scale. And it has the property that its ratio to the Planck length raised to the fourth power is that integer n. Okay. So I'm interested in large n to apply these approximations and treat this as a basically classical theory. And that makes the radius of my anti-de Sitter space large. Okay. So I promised to say something concrete about this space, something that the non-experts can take away as a lesson learned. Okay, just to be pedantic, the five sphere is easy. The five sphere is just the space defined by writing down six coordinates, 3 squared plus x4 squared plus x5 squared plus x6 squared, and saying that the sum of their squares is the ADS length squared, right? That's a higher dimensional generalization of the two sphere. And I wrote this down in a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 dimensional space, and there's one constraint, so it defines a 5 dimensional space, the 5 sphere. Anti-de Sitter space can be defined in much the same way. It turns out that one of the beauties of anti-de Sitter space is that it's a very symmetric space-time, in much the same way the sphere is a very symmetric space. So what I'd really like to do is draw you a picture of anti-de Sitter space. Now, it's hard to draw a picture of five-dimensional space, so I'm going to cheat. And for most of this talk, I'm going to discuss not five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, but two-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. Okay? This is a cheat. The experts know why it's a cheat. But it's not a big cheat, because it turns out this correspondence I mentioned is really a large class of examples. And there are lots of ADS CFT correspondences. And there are certainly correspondences that work for ADS 3, 4, 5, and 6. Okay? Now, I'm choosing 2. 2 has special properties, as the experts know, which means it doesn't really work there, at least not in the simple way we usually discuss. But it's much easier to draw pictures of two-dimensional spaces than to talk about them. And so almost for all the purposes I wish to address in this talk, I can pretend we live in ADS2. It will simplify the treatment. Okay? All right. So I want to start, I want to draw you a picture of two-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. And now how would I do that? Well, we draw pictures of two-dimensional spaces all the time. You just draw something sitting in three dimensions. The trick here is that this is a space-time, which means that one of these directions is actually time. And therefore, if we're measuring things like proper distances, as in special relativity, the time direction gets an extra minus sign. Okay? So So if I say I'm going to draw you a picture inside a three-dimensional space, I have to draw it inside a three-dimensional space that has at least one minus sign. Okay? And, you know, the third dimension is mine to draw, so I'm going to choose the extra dimension to have an extra minus sign too, just to make this problem tractable. So what I'm actually going to do is draw a picture of ADS2 sitting inside of a Minkowski space, a special relativistic flat space-time, which is what we call Minkowski space 1, 2, meaning that it actually has two time directions and one space direction. Okay. Because I can, because it works well that way. The truth is, the great thing about ADS2 is that you can just close your eyes and pretend that these are two space directions and one time direction, and it's not that much different. So this is basically the space-time of 2 plus 1 special relativity if you just, after you do all calculations, interchange space and time. Okay. So here's the point. So this is Minkowski space. I'm going to write down Cartesian coordinates on this space-time. There are two time directions, so I'll call them t1 and t2. And there's a space direction, x. Okay? So anti-de Sitter space can be thought of as the following set of points inside this space-time. Just like the sphere is a set of points satisfying a constraint in sixth-dimensional Euclidean space, anti-de Sitter space is a set of points that satisfy, get my signs right, t1 squared plus t2 squared minus x squared is equal to the anti-de Sitter length squared. Okay. So I'm sure I write down with all the signs that are opposite the signs in the metric. So in the metric of the effective special relativistic theory on this Minkowski space, the t should come with a minus sign, and this should come with a plus sign. So this is proportional to proper distance in that space, but with a factor of minus 1. That means that this surface defined by this constraint shares all the symmetries of, well, shares all the Lorentz symmetries of Minkowski space. This is just a set of points that are a certain proper distance from the origin of this Minkowski space. And as a result, this surface is invariant under rotations and boosts, as in special relativity. Okay. Let me draw you a picture of it. It's kind of useful to draw it two different ways. Let's see. As a relativist, I'm tempted to draw the picture first this way, where I draw a time direction pointing up, and then I would like to draw a space direction pointing sideways. But I have this second time direction, so I guess I'll make that one go into the blackboard. In that kind of depiction, this is a hyperbola. It looks like this. So that's a picture of this surface. And let me just, for convenience, a moment later, also draw it on its side. It's sometimes useful to draw the special direction, the space direction pointing up, in which case I draw a time direction sideways and another time direction back that way. And in this picture, all I've done is turn it on its side. And so it looks like this hyperbola. Okay, but either way, it's invariant under all the Lorentz symmetries in the Minkowski space. All right. So I'll mention one interesting thing about this picture you can see over here. Both the t1 and t2 directions are time directions. So every direction in this plane that cuts vertically through the blackboard is a time direction, including the one that goes around this circle and comes back to itself. Okay. So as I have drawn it, this poor space-time suffers from a problem that it has what are called closed-time-like curves. If you go follow this curve around, you seem to come back into your own past because you can go through the event again and again and again. All right. What that really means is I haven't quite drawn the space-time I actually want. What I want to do is imagine not quite the space-time as drawn, but take this thing and cut it open in one place, and then just let it wrap around itself an infinite number of times without repeating. So we take the universal covering of this space. Okay. Good. But nevertheless, it preserves all the symmetry shown there. All right. Now, in order to study this thing, it's nice to introduce some coordinates that are adapted to the symmetries. And you see there's a rotational symmetry in the T1 and T2 directions. And then you get sort of hyperbolic things in the T2x or T1x directions. So it's nice to understand this by writing T1 is some capital T times sine of some angular coordinate that we'll call tau. And T2 is similarly T cosine tau. That's a switching to polar coordinates on the circle. And if we do that, it's also nice to display this hyperbolic part by writing x as the ADS scale times the hyperbolic sine of some new distance coordinate rho, which I'll stick in a factor of the ADS length to make rho dimensionful. And then the time coordinates, the t, which is the magnitude of the vector in the time directions, turns out to be L ADS times the hyperbolic cosine of rho over S. Okay. You can check via some very short algebra that these definitions automatically satisfy this constraint due to the fact that sine squared plus cosine squared is 1, whereas cos squared minus sin squared is also 1. Okay. Now, what was the point of introducing this? What did I want to teach you about anti-de Sitter space? Well, I wanted to show you the following effect. Okay. Suppose we start at a point in anti-de Sitter space, say on the front of this hyperboloid, and suppose we look at what happens to light rays. Right? Light rays are very interesting in relativistic theories. So light rays, of course, travel at the speed of light, which is a constant speed. And so a light ray that starts off moving here, say towards the future, will begin to wrap around this hyperboloid. But what you see is that although it moves at a constant speed, it's going to start wrapping around circles that get much, much bigger as we go off in this direction. So the angular velocity of the light ray around this circle, the angular velocity in the time directions, goes down. And it turns out, if you do a short calculation, that this rho coordinate I introduced really does measure the proper distance along this hyperboloid. Right? And therefore, what you see is that the size of these circles, the circumference of these circles, is set by t. T, after all, is t1 squared plus t2 squared with a square root. The circumference of these circles increases exponentially fast as you go out in proper distance. Okay? So if the actual speed of the light ray remains constant, it means that the angular velocity in the T12 plane has to be decreasing exponentially because the circles are getting really big. Right? It's the same effect. That's the answer. So it follows that this goes like something exponential. And now you have this interesting effect that if you ask, OK, if I let the light ray go all the way out to rho equals infinity, if you ask, how far does it move around the circle? Well, it's only a finite amount, because the integral of this converges if rho goes to infinity. Okay. So this is an interesting structure for this simple spacetime, which has the property that light rays get to the end of the space in what, in some sense, is a finite time. And one can do a short calculation that I won't bother with. But the answer is that the time interval that elapses as a light ray moves from rho equals 0 to rho equals infinity, okay, where this tau, the fraction of the circle you go around, it turns out it's a quarter of a circle, or this is exactly pi over 2. So light ray actually doesn't get very far before it hits the edge. This brings up an interesting feature of this anti-de Sitter space, which is that stuff tends to run out the edge. Okay, so this points out that in order to have a good theory of dynamics in a space-time like this, it turns out you need some kind of boundary condition to tell you what to do when things hit the edge. All right. Let me draw you another picture of this. Talking about light rays moving off to infinity or things moving off to infinitely far is sort of complicated and hard to visualize sometimes. So it's useful to rescale this picture. Just imagine that we do what's called a conformal rescaling, where I shrink the picture in every place. And I'm going to shrink it infinitely far on the edges to bring this infinite boundary down to a finite distance. So if I do that, then just by the symmetry here, I can draw it as some infinite strip. I'm going to bring in this boundary to a finite distance. This will obey the time direction. Let's call it tau. That's right. But I've shrunk everything else down to a finite distance. As a relative of this, I like to draw pictures where my light rays are simple. I like to draw pictures where my light rays travel at 45-degree angles, no matter what else I've done to the poor space-time. So what I've just done with this calculation is to show you that the path of a light ray that starts in the middle of the anti-de-Sitter space and goes to the edge looks kind of like this, where this is pi over 2. And as I said, we need to add some kind of boundary conditions at the end. There are lots of things we could do. It turns out the system is very flexible. Okay? A simple thing to do and a nice thing to discuss is to keep everything inside the anti-de-Sitter space so that it defines a well-defined, self-contained dynamical system, in which case you would imagine adding some kind of reflecting boundary condition. And so when these things reflect back inside, the light ray may continue its path like that and bounce forever inside the anti-de-Sitter space. Okay.
Don?
Yes?
Has anybody been crazy enough to sort of impose translucent boundary conditions?
Oh, yeah.
Some fraction of things go out?
Yes.
Okay. And what do you get?
All kinds of things. Uh-huh. I'm going to consider you an expert for this purpose, but the short answer is that reflecting boundary conditions of all kinds correspond to making this a self-contained system. Imposing translucent boundary conditions of various kinds correspond to making the system not self-contained. You can make it interact with other things that way. And exactly which boundary conditions you choose and what translucency factors controls the strength of those interactions, et cetera.
You mean interact with things outside the ADS?
Things outside the ADS space.
And what's the physical application?
Well, I'm actually giving a mathematical talk. but on the other side of this duality, it corresponds to coupling this thing to other things. CFT could interact with other systems. It's exactly that. All right. Very good. I wanted to stop here and show you one more interesting feature of anti-de-Sitter space with this picture. So this is some interesting curved geometry. And you see the geometry has this interesting feature that these circles in the time direction grow as you go off towards the boundary. So in general relativity, you know, it's the metric, the shape of the space-time, that accounts for everything that we normally call gravitational forces. And so in particular, it turns out it's the time parts of the metric, over here correspond to the length of these circles, that correspond to some notion of gravitational potential. And so what this picture actually tells us is an anti-de-Sitter space has a gravitational potential which becomes infinitely large at these edges, and it's in some sense small in the middle. That actually is, so what I meant to make that comment and then tie into this picture. If I took not a light ray, but a massive particle, and stuck it here in the middle of anti-de-Sitter space at rest, it shouldn't move in the space direction because it's at rest. It'll just kind of go around the time circle, which I've unwrapped so it's not actually repeating itself, but runs around this way. So in this picture, that would be something that just, the blue is a light ray. And here's our massive particle in purple. It just runs up the middle of anti-de-Sitter space without moving, because it's at rest. Okay. So what I was going to mention is that I commented a few moments ago that this anti-de-Sitter space-time, this surface here, defined by this constraint, shares all the Lorentz symmetries of the Minkowski space. So I can take this circular trajectory that corresponds to here. I'll make it match in color. I can take this circular trajectory, and I can apply a Lorentz boost to it, and it must still be a valid path of some particle moving in anti-Sitter space. Okay. If you're good at visualizing these things and familiar with Lorentz boost, you'll see the answer immediately, but I'll just draw you the picture over here, and the answer is it does something like this. Like so. In particular, if you imagine the T2 axis sticking straight out of the board here and into the board, you'll notice that it will puncture this surface in two places. And as a result, if you do a Lorentz boost in the T1x plane, it leaves that axis fixed. And there are two points on that particle's world line that are fixed by that boost and that don't move. And those two points are right here and here, where the purple and blue and green curves coincide. So what I wanted to show you is they also coincide with the blue curve here. And in fact, this blue curve can be thought of as the limit under an infinite Lorentz boost of that purple straight line, okay? Which is a nice way of deriving in 3 seconds that this is pi over 2 without doing a calculation. This clearly corresponds to this bump when it gets out to the edge, sort of by symmetry. Okay. Well, that was fun. There's lots of concrete things I could say. All right.
Great.
So that's anti-de Sitter space and its geometry. Now, what I want to say, something about this ADS-CFT correspondence and the dictionary between the bulk string theory and the field theory. For this purpose, I'm going to mention something that many people have heard before, which is that the dual field theory can, for certain purposes, be thought of as living on the boundary of the anti-de Sitter space. Okay? So I need to tell you something about how to map, how to translate between things we normally think of as associated with a string theory that I have simplified to small perturbations of quantum fields in the deep interior. I want to tell you how to, somehow translate those into information about things on the edge. Okay. So here is the simple part of the dictionary that we understand well. This is the simple part of the dictionary. Okay. So as I said, in this simple cartoon of string theory, in this limit, you think of the string theory in the bulk as having a collection of quantum fields. So there are fields that live here. I'm going to take one of them and call it phi. There are many others, but let's just pick one for the moment.
Okay.
So how is this related to some things that live on the edge? Well, phi is a function of space and time, which I guess I've called those rho and tau. Okay. And the idea is, if you look at this thing, near the boundary, as rho goes to, in my version here, plus or minus infinity, this field generally will decay because the boundary is infinitely far away. It turns out that for a given field in the bulk, say it's a free massive scalar just for simplicity, it decays at a certain characteristic rate, which there's some number delta, which characterizes the rate. There is the decay factor, exponential in this rho coordinate, and then there's some coefficient. Okay. Now, since I'm talking about the decay as you approach the boundary somewhere, we're going here, that boundary point has only a time coordinate associated with it. Oh, I should call this tau for consistency. And it's this coefficient of the leading decay factor that corresponds to some operator in the dual field theory. So you're pulling off this asymptotic information about the field, and it tells you something about the operator in the dual field theory. I wanted to make a comment here. I mentioned a little bit ago that in order to make the dynamics of these fields self-contained, I need some boundary condition at the edge of my anti-de Sitter space. So you can kind of say the words that, for simplicity and definiteness, let's think of the boundary condition that we impose as being like a Dirichlet boundary condition that forces the field to go to zero out here. Okay? in that analogy, this is the piece which is left. Okay? The next piece which is left. So in a standard problem in a finite cavity, it turns out this piece which is left would be analogous to the Neumann data that we haven't fixed. In other words, we often talk about Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions where you fix either a field or its normal derivative at the boundary. Okay? I wanted to point out that both of these pieces of data, what you would think of as the value of the field at infinity and the value of its normal derivative, are in play in this game. One of them we've fixed as a boundary condition to make the system self-contained, and it's the other one which contains dynamical information about this dual theory. Okay. Great. So, this is the easiest part. This is how you read off bits of the dual theory from the interior. But, of course, the interesting question is, all right, I mean, the interesting question is, if somehow there's this equivalence between a theory that lives all throughout the bulk and a theory that lives on the boundary, well, it looks like there are more dimensions in the bulk. So it looks like there's less information in this boundary theory. Here I've just matched the parts that are easy. This is the asymptotic value of phi, where it has clearly the same amount of information as a boundary theory. So the hard part is, how do I reconstruct information in the interior? The first stages of this, again, are reasonably straightforward, and there's a long history of this. The beginning stages of it were taught to us by Tom and Gary and some people long, long ago. I know it doesn't seem that long ago, but it's 18 years since 1997.
That's long ago.
And there's very much of technology involved here, but it's in this step that my simplification to focus only on anti-de Sitter 2 is going to save me a lot of trouble, because it makes this very easy. Okay? So I want to somehow think about how to reconstruct phi, this bulk field, from O, which is just the boundary values of the field. Okay. So if I'm in anti-de Sitter 2, phi is some kind of field in the bulk. It's some reasonable relativistic field that satisfies some kind of wave equation. I'll write box plus, is it plus m squared? Well, whatever it is, some phi convention equals, as an example. Maybe it's a more complicated wave equation. I want you to notice, though, that what I said a minute ago is we really have both the field on the boundary and its first derivative. This is known as Cauchy data. Okay? If this was a time evolution problem, and I told you you knew the field and its first derivative, you'd say, oh, any wave equation, I can evolve forward in time if I know the fields and their first derivatives. Just like in Newtonian mechanics, if you know position and velocity, you can solve the equations for all time. This looks funny because I want to evolve it sideways. The nice thing about my simplification is that in two dimensions, which for a relativist is one plus one dimension with one space and one time direction, you know, this thing is basically, is roughly speaking, minus dt squared plus dx squared, or it would be that in flat space anyway. And all I'm going to do is switch x and t, but the operator looks the same. It's still a wave equation. So in two dimensions, this is a well-defined Cauchy problem. You still have a wave equation if you evolve it sideways. You may do funny things. A stable wave equation may turn into an unstable one. You know, m squared may become effectively negative. But it doesn't matter. It's still a wave equation, and the Cauchy problem is still well-defined. So in this context, it's just true that if you work hard enough, you can write the field anywhere in the bulk at any point you like in terms of data on the boundary. Moreover, this evolution is going to be causal in this sideways time. It's still a wave equation.
So somehow the fact that you have two time coordinates to start with, that's crucial, is that right?
Well, that kind of went away because, see, I killed one of them with the constraint. Mm-hmm. On the surface, there's only one time direction. The two time coordinates was useful for drawing a picture and making it manifest what the symmetries of the space are. The purpose for what I'm talking about now, I've gotten rid of one of them. I'm just living on the constraint surface. Doesn't matter. Okay. So let me explain what I'm doing here. I'll just redraw my picture to give me a little more space. All right. So in the two-dimensional case, I can draw anti de Sitter space, and I can say, oh, if I want to reconstruct a field phi at this point in the interior, it's clear by this sideways causality that I can do that knowing only the boundary condition and the O's in this region. Okay? Because information will only propagate at the speed of light or slower in this sideways causality. So that was this slick trick. Did everybody catch this business about the wave equation sideways? And it's still causal because it's the same, it's still a wave equation. So the light cones, even turned on their side, are still light cones.
What about when you hit the other side?
We're getting there. That is exactly the interesting question, Richard. Exactly what I want to point out. Okay. First, though, so we can do this. And in fact, I'm going to call these guys over here O-right. And we can also take a point here and evolve it in from this way. We can write phi here in terms of some O lefts that live in this region. Okay. Now, I will make a brief comment. In 1 plus, for ADS2, this is completely trivial. In higher dimensions, in interesting contexts, there can be certain subtleties, and we spent a certain amount of time talking about that in this program, and there are more subtleties that people would like to explore. I'm going to mention that that's an interesting story, but I'm going to gloss over them so I can move forward by talking about other interesting things that come up. Okay. So, make sure I have this three things right. As Richard was saying, what happens when you hit the other side? Or said differently, what happens if I decide I'd like to take this field here, this phi, and I'd like to think of having evolved it this way, and writing that same field operator. I'll move it so I can, there we go. What if I want to think about writing it in terms of these O lefts? Okay. So here, I have two completely separate boundaries. And in terms of this dual field theory, you would think of it as having completely separate degrees of freedom here and here that just, you know, are completely separate. They're not connected in any way in their own space-time. And so they don't actually dynamically interact. So this dictionary appears to have some non-trivial constraints in it. That somehow, when you take this bulk operator and write in terms of the O rights, you can also write in terms of the O lefts, and somehow this all hangs together. So how can that be? Right? Or in other words, what is going on in the dual field theory to enforce these constraints that this combination of O lefts assembled by this sideways evolution at least acts for many purposes like this combination of O rights assembled by this sideways evolution this way? How can that be?
Could you define the word assemble?
Let's see, when did I use it?
You said it's assembled, right?
Assembled by the sideways evolution? All I meant is solve the Cauchy problem to write the field here in terms of the data here. That's some expression. It must somehow be equal, whatever that means, to the corresponding expression found the other way.
Okay.
Got all right. It. Yes?
When you say you have this boundary data O, should I mean, this is dual to some field theory? Am I supposed to think of you are considering some ensemble in the field theory that is to the class of operators you're interested in? If you know this function O, you know what that ensemble is, or?
It's a field theory. It has operators. This is an operator.
Is this an expectation value? Is it?
No, it's the operator.
An operator is an operator that acts on a Hilbert space. It's
not
a function. This is a function.
Yeah, you're an expert, Matt. The two theories are equivalent. Okay, I didn't actually explain what equivalent means, but it means they have the same Hilbert space. So there's some Hilbert space. It's a quantum theory, so they have operators. And this, apparently, is part of the dictionary that tells you how to write one kind of operator, the bulk operators, in terms of the dual operators. So if you like, you can stick this into an arbitrary correlation function at arbitrary state. All right. Good. So how does this work? Okay, and this is one of the questions that's been a lot of fun to discuss in this workshop. How does this work? How does this work? Or more properly, what is it that is enforcing this constraint between the two sides? All right. I will mention that there are sort of two paradigms under discussion. Two paradigms. All right. The first I will call, to give it a name, the code subspace paradigm. Okay. And this is the paradigm of Harry, Dong, and Harlow, okay, about which I will say more in a moment. And the other is the gauge invariance paradigm by, get the right order here, Minton, Polchinski, and Rosenhaus. Okay. Let me say a few words about this one. I'm mostly going to focus on this one because I only have finite time and I can sort of connect it to a further story. But the idea is this. One of the ways in which two dimensions is special, so I'm going to first give you a brief idea about number two. One of the ways in which two dimensions is special is that these two parts of the ADS boundary are really completely disconnected. In higher dimensions, these two lines become, in fact, a connected cylinder. Okay, so there's some connection between the two sides. So the idea of this paradigm is that the dual theory is something like a gauge theory. It has properties like Maxwell theory, and in particular, it has something like a Gauss law constraint that says electric field lines can't end except on charges. And in particular, right. So their idea is that that constraint somehow ties together the different parts of this space-time that lives on the boundary and introduces certain relations that can explain this. That's the basic idea. Then there's this idea, and this one I can say more about. The sort of catchphrase here is that the constraints I just described, the certain expression in terms of the right operators being equal to the expression of the left operators, shouldn't hold universally. It should just hold on some of the states. Okay? The idea is that, well, to tell this story, I took a certain limit. There are some states where that limit is good and some states where it's not. Okay? And if I carefully construct at least a model of what I think the states might look like where this limit is good, I may be able to explain these funny constraints. Okay. I will give you an example, a much simplified toy model. Oh, the magic word here is quantum entanglement, by the way. The idea is that, again, in the real theory, with some higher dimensional system, these two things I've drawn as separate are part of a connected field theory. That field theory may like to be near its ground state, and the ground state tends to be highly entangled, and we can make use of that entanglement to satisfy these constraints. So here's the toy model. Toy model is, consider some system which has two parts. I'll write a Hilbert space, which is a product of two Hilbert spaces. This is just physically two quantum mechanical systems, and we want to talk about them both together. So the space, Hilbert space describing these two systems together is the product of the individual ones. All right. And let's consider a particular state. Oh, suppose that these both have dimension n. OK, great. So let's look at a particular state that I will call 0. I'll think of it as a vacuum for lack of a better name, but I'm just writing down an arbitrary state. And I'll write it down this way. I'll make it the diagonal state. So what I've done is, of course, to introduce a basis of n states in the left space, and a basis of n states in the right space, then there's this completely diagonal state you can write down. Oh, and I suppose I can normalize that for you. Why not? Okay. So there's a state. Now, notice the following. Suppose I have an operator in the right space that acts on this state. Well, by linearity, I can just push it through all of this sum, I equals 1 to n, to write it as I left, and then O right acts on I right. So let me write that in the way we usually do, as a sum over the remaining states of some O right ij times the j states, or in other words, 1 over root n sum I and j equals 1 to n, O, I, j, right, I, left, j, right. Okay. All I've done is rearrange terms. Clearly, I can do the same thing with an operator on the left side. So O left, acting on the vacuum, is going to give us the same expression with left and right interchanged. So 1 over root n sum I j equals 1 n O left. Let's see. I said I want to interchange I and j, but it will be easier to read if I keep them the same here and switch them here, which is the same thing. Okay. So what you see is that given any operator on the right side, I can construct a partner on the left, and as long as I choose the sort of partner operator on the left, which I'll put a tilde on to make it definite, as long as I choose its matrix elements to be the same as those of the one on the right that I started with, but with a switch, with a transpose, then I find that indeed O right on the vacuum is the same as O left on the vacuum. I get the same result. So on this particular entangled state, given any operator constructed on the right side, I can find an operator on the left which has the same action. I mentioned a few things. This is a transpose, not a Hermitian adjoint. This is not a canonical operation. It depends on the choice of a particular state I constructed here. Okay, but never you mind. What I've shown you is that there, given a state of this kind, I can imagine that all kinds of constraints are satisfied relating the left and right sides. Okay. In particular, here, in my simple example, acting on one state, I've managed to find a friend on the left for every operator on the right. Okay. So from there, you can imagine that with more cleverness, you could refine this idea and do things that are similar but different. If you expand this to where you want this kind of mapping to work not just on one state, but on some reasonably small number of states, you should be able to accommodate that, as long as maybe you don't want to be able to map an arbitrary operator here, the other side, but just some, you know, class of such things. And so that's the idea. Amit is biting. Oh, he's going to get a comment. Okay, yes.
Question.
Question.
Is it clear that the Hilbert space of these two field theories, let's say, that live on the boundary, can be written as a tensor product, given that operators on the left and the right do not commute, given the space-time?
In this setup, there are two separate field theories on the left and right. By definition, they commute.
No, but the picture tells you that they don't commute.
That's one of the questions. How does it work? Good question. How do you reproduce the bulk algebra from the boundary?
We're allowed to extend the question to what does it work?
We are allowed to ask, how does this work? Does it work? What is the story? OK? Okay? This is your model of how it works, simplified and crunched down to two dimensions. What you've told me is that, yes, it looks like there's a problem here. You know, we're in the same operator in the bulk represented this way and that way. Bulk operators shouldn't commute with each other. But things on the right commute with things on the left. Oh, I'm sorry. Right. This doesn't work.
Okay.
This is one of the ways in which the two-dimensional model is bad. Shh. You're right. This absolutely does not work. I'm sorry. For exactly the reason you said. This can only reproduce a commuting subalgebra in the ball. Okay. Great. Let's not worry about that. All right. Yes, indeed. Okay. What was all this? Oh, yes, you know, that was my next comment.
Awesome.
All right, this is part of the idea, and it's interesting to explore, and it explains part of what's going on, or it could potentially explain part of what's going on. It explains how these non-trivial constraints can be satisfied. It also explains part of, well, as Ahmed was mentioning, there are all these fields involved. And they have some field algebra. We're often interested in things like the commutator of two field operators. Okay? Especially because in a relativistic theory, like string theory, a relativistic theory like string theory, the commutator is something that should vanish at space-like separations. And we take that to encode the fundamental causality of the theory. And, you know, an interesting question here is, since causality has to do with propagation and light rays, and that involves this radial direction orthogonal to the boundary. Interesting question is, how does the dual field theory know about causality in this radial direction? So one way to probe that is try to understand this algebra. How does it make these things commute? I'll write equals 0 with a question mark when these two things have space-like separation. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the things that Ahmed and his collaborators were focusing on. In my toy model here, this overdoes it, okay? But clearly, if I have an operator that I can write as a function of things on the right, and if I can also write as a function of things on the left, well, suppose I had two operators and I wanted to do their commutator. If I can write this one in terms of things on the right, and this one in terms of things on the left, and if these are truly distinct physical systems, then O left commutes with O right. It's just trivial because they don't involve each other. Okay. So that explains how to get some zeros. Okay. Now, as Ahmed was pointing out, his analysis in the higher dimensional case does better. It also explains how to get some things that are not zero. Okay. And that's good. That's good. However, it does look like there's more to understand here, because the way you show that some things are zero is, you have two things you want to commute, and you push them into opposite regions. So in the higher dimensional context, let's look at ADS3. ADS3, in which case the boundary looks like this, is a cylinder, okay? Or at one time, the boundary at T equals 0 is a circle. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if I include the bulk, I just have to fill in the cylinder. I make this a solid three-dimensional object, and I fill in this disk. Okay. So one of the interesting things about these theories, about string theory and its dual field theories, is that not only are there local operators in the dual field theory, but the dual field theory contains string-like operators that wrap all the way around the boundary. And causality in the bulk would suggest that this is another operator at the same time, and it should commute with this thing in the middle. But now that this thing goes all the way around the boundary, it's like in my example here, having built it out of both left and right pieces, and now I can't localize it any place where it obviously commutes with each other. So there's more here to understand, but somehow there's a very interesting paradigm here that's been suggested that seems to make a lot of progress towards resolving these constraints.
On, can I ask, I have a very naive question.
Yes.
In the story so far, right, the string-string interaction doesn't come in at all.
Right.
So the space-time, the ADS space-time is just sitting there, and no gravitons propagating around, bouncing off each other.
I told you I was taking a very narrow set of things
I understand. But shouldn't the full force of string theory come in somehow, somewhere? I mean, so far, the first few chapters of Joseph.
The full force of something has to come in, okay? Right? And so it basically comes in, it may come in the list of open questions I was about to present without further commentary.
Perfect.
All right. So this is all very interesting. Let me list some of the questions, okay? All right. There was this interesting idea that you can reconstruct part of the bulk by using this sideways causal evolution.
But,
you know, the theory on the boundary is some self-contained theory by construction. So all of these operators are things that I could, in principle, write in terms of things at one time here by using the Heisenberg equations of motion in this theory to rewrite them in terms of t equals 0. You can always take any field theory and rewrite it in terms of its data at one time. But that means that I should be able to reproduce this bulk operator, not just by knowing the O's over a large time, but even knowing the O's over a tiny time. So how do I do it when the place I want to reach in the bulk is not in this sideways causality sense, you know, determined by the boundary data? Right? It's an open question. At least suggestions based on the way we understand that you compute entanglement entropy in ADS CFT, that even for relatively small regions on the boundary, they can sometimes determine what goes on in a large distance into the interior. Whether or not that's really true is, I'm sure, going to be an active discussion in the program, and also exactly how it works. All right, other interesting questions. Okay, not only did I ignore interactions, as Tony was saying, I've been working here with small excitations around empty anti-de Sitter space. A question on everyone's mind is, what happens inside black holes? Okay, that's interesting because inside black holes, well, I won't make you do the causal mental gymnastics, but bottom line is, this kind of sideways evolution never penetrates inside what I'm going to call true black holes. It never penetrates into what are called causal shadows. Okay, so there's deep regions there. You can't hit this way, in principle. What happens there? Also, black holes are supposed to be high entropy states. They are in classical general relativity. We expect they dominate over in the microcanonical ensemble in over most of the range of energies. So a generic state in the theory should be a black hole. In this subspace paradigm, its slogan is that the bulk is reproduced by the boundary in a simple way, at least respecting bulk microcausality, only on a small set of states. So what happens for black holes, which are generic states? Good question. All right. Also, it turns out that there's a simple counting argument. Black holes, you think of them as kind of being finite size things here, but it turns out on the inside, you know, people always say you get crunched and you fall into a black hole, but there's actually it turns out if you fall into a black hole head first, your shoulders get crunched, but your head gets stretched out from your feet. And as a result, there's a direction inside black holes that's actually growing very large. And so it turns out there's a lot of space inside black holes. And so there's a simple entropy argument that says that a simple map like this, wherever it was, okay, between operators, can't possibly reproduce the bulk field algebra over the entire black hole interior. You'd need more states than you have in the CFT. So how does that work? And when and where does it work? And last but not least, okay, if this doesn't really work, well, I don't know. If there's a limitation to how well this works inside black holes, I mentioned at the very beginning that we don't really have a good non-perturbative definition of string theory from first principles in most contexts. In 1997, and years thereafter, it was mentioned as a hope that this ADF CFT correspondence could be used to define string theory, because we know what the dual field theories are. But obviously, if there is some limitation to how well this bulk reconstruction works, maybe inside black holes or something, then you can ask lots of questions about whether this program can, in fact, be pushed to completion. Can you, in fact, use ADS CFT to completely define string theory in the bulk? And that can be a topic of discussion, and so I will simply end there. Thank you.
You mentioned the state of might be the ground state of the boundary theory.
That was the idea.
But in our other program, we think of ground states as having low entanglement, normally. That is, having area laws rather than.
That's true. That will be related to the idea that this may work only on an even smaller subset of states than you might hope.
So it's not the ground state.
No, it's the ground state, but it has low entanglement, so it only gives you the resources to make this constraint work for a small set of operators.
Oh, okay. Well, extremely unusual operators from the point of view of the boundary theory.
Extremely unusual.
Well,
Let's see. Tell me if I'm saying this wrong. There are operators that are very, you might say, coarse-grained, is that a good word? They're not sensitive to defined structure. They certainly don't live on a single lattice site.
Right.
They're spread out.
They will be non-local operators.
Though they'd be fundamentally non-local.
Yeah.
They might have a length scale which is short compared to something else of interest, but they're probably not exactly local operators.
So you told us how to do ADS2 construction of these boundary operators. And then you also said that it only works on the commuting subalgebra in the bulk, right? And is there any way to...
Well, I said that if this really was a duality in two dimensions, it would imply that the entire algebra in the bulk is commuting.
Yeah? Yeah. So this construction works in general for all... I mean, this construction of OL or right, how you constructed the boundaries.
You mean in the higher dimensional case?
No, just in this case. I understood that. I thought it didn't work.
What is it? Two dimensions is not a legitimate candidate for many reasons. This can be viewed as one of them. Okay?
Yeah, but I'm asking about what happens in two dimensions.
Well, what happens for what? If I simply have...
How do you construct the boundary?
There isn't a duality in two dimensions that I want to discuss. There's a mathematical physics problem in two dimensions, which is given a bulk field, how can I reconstruct it from its boundary data? That problem is just a problem in wave mechanics and is solvable this way. And it tells you that operators on this side do not, in fact, commute with operators on this side. It tells you that O left and O right do not commute, so these cannot be thought of as in principle separate quantum systems.
Okay.
Yeah, that's really the...
Okay. Yeah. And so what if I turn it around and say, well, as a kinetic metaphysicist, I don't really care about gravity. I want to give you an arbitrary state, wave function on the outside.
Yeah.
Is there a way, sort of a unique prescription, even in principle, you think, which takes one into this some space, maybe it's ADS, maybe it's more complicated, which we can use independent of conformal field theory? Could we want to do
ask that one more time? You want to know, you're asking about a bulk theory, or you're saying,
given a
quantum field theory,
quantum
whatever
field theory in any state.
State, yep.
Is there a procedure, some sort of normalization procedure,
right.
which
constructs
a
bulk
encode some of the features of that state in some higher dimensional space, independent of whether or not the field theory state happened to be in a conformal field theory? It could be some high energy density state. It could be whatever state we want.
There are many levels in which to ask that question. In the broadest question, which is, given an arbitrary state in an arbitrary, say, local quantum field theory, is there a bulk representation of it?
Yeah.
We'd all love to know the answer to.
Okay.
It's a hard question. various, there's various speculations on that, and it may depend on even what your definitions are of what you allow to be a bulk representation of it. What I will say is that certainly for the cases we understand, when there are conformal field theories that we understand how to represent a Jernih bulk, you can certainly study all kinds of deformations of those theories that break conformal invariance. So conformal invariance is not by itself a key feature. Okay, but how large is the class of theories that can be usefully represented this way is unclear. You know, if you have a set of theories that do not have a useful notion of a large n limit, is there a representation of this kind? I don't know.
Thanks, Don.